Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day. I'm coming live from my den under the stairs here in Bolton, UK. I'm surrounded by my stuff. If I turn to my left, there's my ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, most unusual. Very unusual. This is her appearance as Tammy in the new Avengers episode, Angels of Death, playing a nurse in a secret conspiracy to kill off members of the government. It's bonkers. To my right is my great library of tabletop RPGs and my Grognard files. I'm going to pull down this file. It's not a game. It's not a supplement. But a magazine. Imagine Adventure Games magazine. For players of the Dungeons & Dragons game are in a circle. It wasn't all about White Dwarf in the UK back in the day. There was a contender, a pretender to the throne. This episode is another two-parter, exploring this great magazine, its features and its impact on the RPG scene. I need to budge up a bit. There's hardly any room in the den, as it's filled up with boxes of fanzines that are due to be shipped, or posted, as we say in Bolton, to the corners of the world. Australia, America, Canada, Japan. Well, if not the corners, then some of the nooks and crannies of the world. There are 100 limited edition hard copies that have been produced. And there's still a chance to get a copy if you go to thegrognardfiles.com, you find out how. I always wanted to have a gaming fanzine. In fact, back in 1984, we put together a dummy copy of The Armchair Adventurer with bits and pieces written by all three of us. It wasn't very PC, I'm afraid. I remember an hilarious article for artificial limbs for RuneQuest characters. Mobility options for those unlucky adventurers who'd copped it and had arms and legs lopped off, and no healing six. The zine never saw the light of day, as the only photocopier in the neighbourhood was the local grocer, and he'd bought a batch of pink paper, and there were reams and reams of it, and he insisted that he was going to use it all up before he got any white stuff. And for months and months, our character sheets were bright pink. And the only other option was the library, where it was impossible to print double-sided. In either case, the 10p a copy was prohibitive too. The idea was abandoned, as my life became subsumed by postal games. I set up my own PBM and lost part of my adolescence. But that's another story for another day. Why did I want to produce a fanzine? Well, it was so it would appear in Imagine, Adventure Games magazine, and for the players of Dungeons & Dragons are in a circle. It was produced in the UK by TSR between April 1983 and October 1985, running for 31 editions. And in the back pages, there would be a regular column about fanzines. And they were very good at engaging with players of the hobby. Back in February of this year, it happened again. I was inspired to do a fanzine thanks to reading the Imagine magazines rediscovered in the attic. Something was awakened, and I finally decided to produce a fanzine of my own. Don't worry, there are no lame jokes about being lame in the new version. Instead, there's a cover by Russ Nicholson, a RuneQuest story by author Justin Hill, art from Mark Lamming, as well as the usual bobbins from me, Blythe, at Daily Dwarf, and Eddie. Revisiting Imagine has reminded me how inspiring it was. I go up into the attic in this part of the episode with Blythe, and we look through our collection of Imagine magazines. It's a very soporific discussion. We're more somnolent than usual. I put it down to us both being a bit tired, and it's quite dark up there and warm. Don't worry though, because the podcast will soon spark back into life as we're joined by none other than Paul Coburn, all the way from New Zealand. He was the editor of Imagine, and he shares with us his experiences of setting up the magazine and how he got into the gaming hobby. At Daily Dwarf has gatecrashed the party to talk about Dave Langford and Critical Mass, which of course appeared in White Dwarf. But I always thought that Imagine covered the science fiction hinterland better than White Dwarf. At Daily Dwarf has submitted the case for the defence. In the next part, I will put forward the counter-argument with Colin Greenland and Dave Pringle's contributions to Imagine. Okay, grab yourself a strong coffee, a choc chip hobnob, and ramblers, let's get rambling.
Show and tell!
Well, we've climbed up to the very summit of Dirt Towers, to the attic. I think we've only once been here before. I've got Blythe with me. Hiya, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
Yeah, we've only been up here once before when we had the Moorcock episode to do with the second part of Stormbringer. This is the attic where we store the archive of arcane RPG material we handed over to the spiders, and we come up here every so often just to have a delve and a dove. Can you dove? I don't know if you can dove.
I don't know.
Have a delve and a dove to try and find some little nuggets from role-playing's past. Now, later on in the podcast, Paul Coburn, in the second part of this episode, is going to pick specific elements of regular features of it. What I thought we'd do, Blythe, is look at our respective magazine collections.
Yes.
And look at a couple of specific magazines.
Yes. That sounds like a good idea, yeah.
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 So, I'm going to, if you can you pass that box over there? There's my box.
Oh. Okay, there you go.
Not that one.
Oh, this one?
No, put that one back.
All right. Not all right, yeah. No. Oh, I see. All right, yes, okay.
Put that one back, yeah.
We won't look in there.
Okay, this is the one. Right. I have to keep my collection somewhere.
Yes.
Right, so, yeah. So what we're going to do, and you've got your box.
Yes.
I've got my box.
Yes.
And we're going to pull some magazines at random,
okay,
and talk about it.
All right.
Until we get bored of each other's company.
Like, yes.
That's how it normally works.
Isn't it? Usually about 20 minutes.
Okay. So, have you noticed this box? This is an old box I got from a supermarket with Weetabix, boxes of,
yes,
Weetabix.
I can see that, yeah.
And if you notice, it's one of those from Weetabix, if you don't know. Is a breakfast cereal.
It's an international audience, isn't it? Not everyone knows what Weetabix is. They probably think it's something to do with Brexit. That sounds like a breakfast cereal, I always think. Would you like Brexit? Would you like milk on your Brexit?
Well, it's a kind of a breakfast cereal, Weetabix. That is in lozenge shaped, isn't it?
Lozenge shaped biscuit, yeah. Sort of like, yeah, I think that's the way to describe it.
Yeah, you pour milk on it.
Yes.
And it's awful, isn't it, really? I mean, you'd
well, be better things to eat in the morning.
Yeah. Bit of sugar on it.
Yeah.
But there was a time, wasn't there, in the late 80s, if you look on this box, where they used to think it was appropriate to advertise it with skinheads.
They did, didn't they? Yeah. I'm like, sure if you do a Google image, Weetabix skinheads, you'll come up with what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they did, yeah. And so, I mean, but as it's fair to say, I think it's fair to say, in case you're any skinheads listening, because you never know.
No.
It wasn't a far-right organisation to start with. It was very multicultural, wasn't it?
The skinhead movement. Yeah.
It has its origins in black music and all that. But I think it's fair to say, by the time Weetabix were using it, it had pretty much become associated with the far-right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm not sure what they were trying to achieve with it, you know. Yeah,
it was appropriated, wasn't it, by the far-right boot boys and...
Romper Stomper. Yeah. But they were using, like a kind of cartoon skinhead to advertise the cereal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tickets.
Yeah, very odd.
Anyway, that's by the by. It's the content of this box that we're interested in.
That could be the high point of this discussion. I've got to set people off now researching the skinhead movement.
Yeah, well, other parts.
And Weetabix. they all know about this role playing rubbish. They don't know about that. Mm-hmm. See? It's an education.
So, we're going to pull one of these out of our respective boxes. And then we're going to. I mean, back in the day, did you get quite a lot of Imagine magazines?
I bought quite a few, but I didn't buy it quite as regularly as White Dwarf.
Yeah. I think we had subscriptions to White Dwarf, didn't we?
We did for a while. I had a subscription for a while. But even when the subscription lapsed, I still bought it pretty religiously. I mean, you know, White Dwarf was out and you would buy it. It wasn't really questioned. I would never question myself, do I need this copy of White Dwarf? Imagine is a little bit different because sometimes I'd look at a copy and think, well, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if that was, looking back on some of these issues, and I know we're going to talk about them in a minute, I think that might have been a bit of a mistake, actually, on my part.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, I used to buy them fairly regularly. I used to, because, as you know, I've always had like a thing for like a magazine.
You do,
a
magazine.
And comics, that kind of thing. So I used to buy them fairly regularly, but I don't think I read them. Looking back on it now, I think it was a pure case that I would pick them and flick through them endlessly.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think it's because, compared with the stuff that was in White Dwarf, it's fairly substantial, isn't it? The articles are, there's stuff to read, isn't it?
The articles are quite lengthy, aren't they? Yeah. Whereas in White Dwarf, they were never that lengthy.
No,
I don't think they were. You'd get double pager, wouldn't you? But in Imagine, you get sometimes run to 3-4, even 5 pages sometimes.
Yeah.
This one's looking at one now. 1, 2, 3, four sides. And quite lengthy article.
Substantial, I think. It allowed some of the writers at the time, like Graham Davis, to kind of breathe.
Yeah.
And work an idea.
Yeah. Well, I think White Dwarf was very compartmentalised, wasn't it? So you get a copy of White Dwarf and you would know what you were getting, and as a 14, 15 year old, you would be able to kind of easily unpack it and look at, I'll look at Rune Rights, I'll look at this, I'll look at that, I'll look at whatever. You look at copies of Imagine and they do have regular bits, regular departments. But there's less of that, isn't there? There's less of that. There's more articles. There's more substantial articles, and therefore it's less compartmentalised.
Which is actually,
looking back on it now, is quite a good thing.
Yeah.
But at the time, it meant it was perhaps a little bit more, I don't know, a bit harder to get into, harder to get focus on when you're that age. I don't know.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing is that, I suppose we'll discuss this as we're going through it, on the front page every time it said... for players of the Dungeon Dragons R game.
TM. Yes, it did. Focus on that. We'll come on to this, won't we? I think in terms of the cover, it put itself out as for players of Dungeon and Dragons. But I'm not sure the contents necessarily followed suit. But we'll come on to that, won't we?
Yeah.
That's an interesting topic.
It's a house magazine for TSR, but it felt like it was. White Dwarf was a house magazine for Games Workshop, because they could have put on the front for the players of games that we have licensed for.
Yeah, they could have done, yeah. It's not quite as snappy as for players of the Dungeons and Dragons game, is it? No. But even so, yeah. Yeah, they were house magazines, but I think Imagine... from a cover perspective, certainly, gave that impression that it's for people who play D&D, basically, or TSR games, so maybe a bit of Star Frontiers thrown in, that kind of thing.
Yeah. What we could say about it, returning to these magazines and looking at them again, it's one of those situations where retrospectively you realise how good they were.
Didn't appreciate it
at the time.
No, we didn't really. No, and I think that partly was because, as we've discussed in these podcasts several times, we didn't play a lot of D&D. We didn't play a lot of D&D until much, much later. So at the time, we were playing RuneQuest, Traveller, Stormbringer, Call of Cthulhu. You know, those were the games we were playing. So there was a sense in which perhaps Imagine never felt like it was for us, because it put itself out there as for people who played D&D. But as I say, I think looking back on it, I think that's a bit of a mistake, maybe on our part, that once you read a little bit more deeply into it, it's kind of for everyone, really, isn't it?
Well, let's have a look at some of the issues. Okay. I think, are you going to have Adele first?
Okay, I'll have Adele in, yeah. Have a look. And, oh dear.
What have you got?
Issue number 20, November 1984. Now, it doesn't say players of the D&D game on the front, but it does say clerics. It's a special issue on clerics in the D&D game.
Well, that's a good one.
I'm amazed I even bought this. Maybe I bought it to burn and just forgot to. Yeah. So it's an issue about the most boring character class in D&D.
Well, does it make it any more interesting?
No. Yeah, it does. It does, actually. And it's actually a very good issue. And I think what's interesting about it, it picks up on some of the things I don't like about clerics. There's a very good article about clerics generally, which makes the point that the problem with clerics in D&D is that every character class... you can relate to a figure from fantasy fiction or movies.
Yeah, so there's like warriors, a standard archetype.
Exactly. Warriors, Conan, King Arthur, Aragorn, you know, thieves, you've got the Grey Mouser, Bilbo Baggins, that kind of thing. You know, magic users, there's, you know, wizards. There's plenty of wizards out there, isn't there? You can Gandalf, whoever, Merlin. But there's no clerics. There's no the idea of a kind of medieval priest doesn't really feature in fantasy fiction. And there's a great article in it that makes that point, and then goes on to kind of talk about making clerics more interesting and kind of fleshing them out as characters.
So how does it propose you do that? Is that
let me just find it.
Because I think what it lacks, I mean, you know, I know that we always do this, but if you compare it to RuneQuest, what RuneQuest has got to help you be a cleric, if you like, and steeped in religion, it gives you the infrastructure and the organisation around the religions and the gods to help you motivate a character and build a character and progress a character.
And that's what it is. It's an article by Paul Vernon. Clerics are people too. And it makes this point, you know, that there are none of these archetypes for clerics. But the way it does it, I suppose, is a little bit like... I mean, I think it actually refers to RuneQuest, you know, and uses that almost as a model for making a cleric more interesting by fleshing out the religion. I think what it picks up on is, there are no archetypes in fantasy fiction, but the way to make a cleric interesting is to focus on the religion, which is what D&D back then didn't really do.
No.
You know, and it even talks about deities and demigods, which I've got a copy of, and even that doesn't really talk about it. Mentions the gods and gives the stats for all the gods, as if who cares about that.
It's the organizational
dimension. It doesn't really, the early editions of Deities and Demigods doesn't really do that. It talks about all those kind of things that make a cleric more interesting, and of course that's what does make a cleric more interesting, you know, that they've got some kind of religion, some code of behaviour and that kind of thing. And that's how RuneQuest makes its characters interesting, you know.
Yeah. I think that's got one in that I remember from back in the day. Correct me if I'm wrong, is it got one by Graham Davis, which it about the do you see him die? About that's it, as God's my witness.
Yeah, there is. There's a bit about
trial by ordeal.
Trial by ordeal, trial by combat, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Medieval
Because what Graham Davis
trials, yeah.
What Graham Davis did in those articles, he kind of gave some historical context and encouraged you to use them in games, didn't he? So in that one, it was kind of using different religious trials and things.
Yeah.
The idea was is that you'd have these trials to test whether there was the divinity shone upon you, so you're like forced to, in a position where you know if you were
innocent, God would show favour and you'd be all right.
Yeah,
you wouldn't drown or you wouldn't burn or that kind of thing. Yeah.
I think there's a picture fig one, and there's not a fig two, so I don't know why they bothered putting a fig one.
Fig one, some shields with spiky bits.
I think I adapted that for a game.
And there's an interesting article as well. About clerical weapons, which again sort of points out that slight silliness about using an edge weapon.
Yeah.
And I think it talks about something that I think we adapted into our early D&D games. When we played a lot of basic D&D, I think I games mastered it. And I brought this in because I got a bit fed up with this edged weapon thing, where a cleric has a holy weapon, has a cult weapon. That's the only weapon they're allowed to use. So you might allow a cleric to use a spear or a sword, but that's their kind of, a bit like Hermact in RuneQuest with the broadsword, that's their cult weapon. So it's better than an edged weapon, but that's the only weapon they're allowed to use to kind of slay people for their religion. So it's quite a good idea. And I think I remember adapting that into our games. But I think I think we'll come back to this again and again during this discussion. What's interesting about it is that on the front cover, it talks about clerics in D&D, and yet a lot of the articles are reasonably generic. So the article you've just mentioned, the Graham Davis one, that's not really for D&D.
No,
that could be incorporated into any game.
Yeah. And so as I say, I think I used it as a trial.
RuneQuest. Yeah. And it's interesting that they talk about, they have some new flails and maces, and yet they give new flail types. Again, Graham Davis, some new ways of clerics, weapons for clerics to use. But they give the weapon stats for Dragon Quest, Traveller even, basic role-playing, Tunnels and Trolls, and Bushido, as well as D&D. So it's almost like it's a magazine for D&D, but they're constantly tugging away from D&D, trying to make it a bit more inclusive,
Is that something... I mean, we've mentioned, haven't we, that they seem to give the contributors more space to write and explore an idea. And there's like quite a bit of crossover, wasn't there, between... writers for White Dwarf and Imagine. Doesn't Lewis Pulsifer have
Lewis Pulsifer, the great Lewis Pulsifer appears.
He's got one in
article
there.
On alignment.
You'd like that,
I do, but I don't like some of this. Alignment, personality and religion. So it's not specifically about clerics, but it touches on the idea that I suppose alignment might be more important for a cleric than any other character class. But it's a bit It's an odd one to read, because I think the other tussle, if that's the right word, that it kind of highlights is that between perhaps wargamers and role players.
Yeah.
So what Lewis Pulsifer does is talks about alignment, and he says, chaotic action. So he talks about chaotic characters, and he mentions something about making a chaotic character, roll a dice to make decisions and things like that. And it always kind of irritates me, this, because someone who's chaotic good in D&D, they're not total maniacs who just decide what we're going to do. I'll tell you what, we're going to do this morning. All right, I'll tell you, there's six options. Let's randomly decide what we do. No, they don't do that, do they? Robin Hood's a classic chaotic good character. He doesn't make random decisions, does he?
No. I mean, to be fair, when I've looked at this, I think he doesn't advocate it as a thing that
he doesn't.
He suggests it as a means of. But
what I think is interesting is his approach to alignment is a bit gamey.
Yeah.
rather than saying, look, you know, these are alignments, but what they're suggesting is you should role play it. So he sort of he talks about hit points, you know, that a lawful character should get a sort of average hit points every time they go up a level, whereas a Celtic character should roll, you know, or something like that. And you think that it's a very game-based way of approaching alignment. Whereas when you look at some of the other articles in it, so the ones about, more sort of generic about clerics, they're talking about the idea of role-playing it a little bit more. You know?
Well, it certainly feels that kind of conflict is being played out between gaming and the story, isn't it?
That comes across. It particularly comes across in this issue as well, you know.
Let me have a delve in my box, see what I've got. Oh, this is one of the later ones as well. This is it's the one that comes immediately afterwards. It's December 1984, number 21, and it's the superhero edition.
Yeah.
And they used to have these genre-specific issues.
We did, and I think going back to what we were saying earlier, maybe that's one of the reasons I didn't buy it as religiously as White Dwarf, because I've not got that issue, and I wouldn't have bought it because we didn't really play any superhero role playing.
But I think what's interesting reading this now is it was for TSR's Marvel superheroes role playing game. And the main thing that it features is a scenario by Paul Colburn, quite a substantial scenario, a one-on-one scenario.
No.
So a games master plus player called Kiss of Death, where you get to play as a player Captain Britain.
Oh, Captain Britain.
Yeah, yeah, has an exclusive. I'll come and rescue you once I've had a brew.
That's right. His weakness is if you play the national anthem to him, he has to stand up and salute.
That's it, yeah.
He has to stop whatever he's doing. It's like his kryptonite.
Yeah, the bad guy in here, you know.
recording the national anthem in his pocket, he plays now and again, so he can make his escape.
Exactly. So, it features other characters as well. Like Nick Fury makes an appearance, and the baddie is Super Skrull. I think this was Super Skrull. Super Skrull.
Super Skrull. I thought you said Super Squirrel then. I thought, God, we're back onto giant badgers again, aren't we? Super Badger and his sidekick, Super Squirrel.
Well, the Captain Britain probably would be good against Super Skrull. He'd be protecting the red squirrels, wouldn't it?
Super Squirrel was like a grey squirrel.
Yeah.
Yes, trying to destroy the red ones. Yeah. That works, that. I might write that down.
We'll have that. the other thing in it, which I loved, it's got Pelennor, the City League, and it has the arena in it.
Mm.
And it's beautifully drawn, plans for the arena and some of the characters that you'd find in there. And what was good about Pelennor, when they gave NPCs, they would describe their motivations, what they knew, little features about them that you could pepper the game with. So I think it's really, really good, and it gives you some plot lines that you can run within an arena, and it gives you rules for chariot race. I know you don't like a game within a game.
You know me and games in a game.
But it gives you pretty effective rules for chariot races. You recreate Ben-Hur. Ben-Hur with little squares of cardboard. The other thing it's got of note in here, you flick to the back, is do not ask for whom the bell jingles. And it's a mini module for Christmas. And they used to have these kind of novelty dungeons in there.
They did, and I think, again, looking back now, reading it now, it's quite good fun, isn't it? But at the time, I think as a poor-faced 15-year-old, we were a bit sniffy about that, weren't we?
Yeah.
How dare people have fun with role-playing?
Yeah.
It's a serious exercise.
I think we've covered before that, you know, back in the day, we had no sense of humour whatsoever.
Did we?
You know, the encounters.
Some would say we haven't now, but...
You know, you can encounter a snowman who's going to chuck snowballs at you. The character, you know, the ultimate boss is Santa Claus at the end. And if you look at the dungeon plan in the middle, it's got like a round atrium in the middle, which is actually a polo mint.
Polo mint, yeah.
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 So...
Polo mints aren't very Christmassy though, are they?
No, no, but I think it's the ice thing. It's the ice thing. Ice covered. It's white, isn't it? But
yeah.
The best of these adventures that they had was one that was in an earlier issue, issue 15. I think it's called Round the Bend. The play characters were Half-Orcs, Severed the Wizard, and he was studying, and he dropped his lens of minute seeing down the sink, down the plug hole.
Mm. Yeah.
And what he does is actually shrinks the player characters to a size so they can go down the plug hole, and the adventure becomes going down the plug hole.
Down the drain.
Down the drain. Mm. A really clever idea.
As good as Captain Britain and Super Squirrel.
Yeah.
Almost as good as that idea.
Almost as good.
Almost, not quite.
Not quite. So that's a good issue, that, number 21.
Right. This is the next issue after the last one.
I might have
put them in order.
Who'd have thought somebody like you, as retentive as you, would put them in order.
It's hard to believe, isn't it? issue 19, October 84. Now, this is a funny issue for a number of reasons. Going back to the idea that it's a TSR house magazine, on the front it's got a picture of some Viking warriors, like a battle. Yeah. And it says on the front, a cast of thousands introducing the Dungeons & Dragons companion set. And this was, the companion set was, you had the basic, then you had the expert. The companion set, I think, was for character levels 15 plus. And I think it had battle rules in, hence the picture of the battle on the front. So you open the magazine expecting there's going to be some big thing about that. Doesn't mention it. The only mention of it is there is a scenario in here called Sinvel's Peril, which does say that you need basic, expert and companion rules. But there's no article about the companion. It's almost like they were told, right, you're going to have to mention the companion stuff. Stick it on the front cover.
Yeah.
They said, we don't really want to write anything about it. It doesn't matter. Your masters at TSR have said, put it on the front. So they have done. But when you open it, it's not really meant. They don't really talk about it. They just ignore it, really. So there you go. It's quite funny. And again, this thing of, you've got some interesting articles. You've got one called Towards Systemless Scenarios. You would imagine, wouldn't you, that... Did you like that?
Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
Seamless.
It is, isn't it? You would imagine that a TSR house magazine would be very much about TSR games and would be very much trying to say, look, these are the games you want to be interested in.
Yeah.
But it's not doing that. It's talking about systemless scenarios. There's actually a piece by Paul Vernon, Uncharted Stars, which is for Traveller. So it is interesting. And another as a really interesting article, actually, which is quite, I say it's not funny, but it it's funny in terms, it's called Role Playing for Remedials. Now, and I don't know if you can you use the word remedial
anymore? I don't think.
Are you allowed to? I don't know. Yeah. But this is 1984, so you are allowed to use the word remedial. Role Playing for Remedials.
I think they call it interventions now, don't they?
Do they? Role Playing for Interventions doesn't have the same ring to it, does it?
No.
By someone called Alan Heaven. Alan Heaven? I've never heard of Alan Heaven before. But on the face of it, you think role playing for remedials. Oh, is it like role playing for dummies? Is it some kind of guide to role playing? But it's not. It's not at all. It's quite a serious article.
Right.
I'm laughing, but it's not funny. It's quite a serious article.
I'm not laughing then.
I don't know. Well, I've got a serious article about the idea of bringing role playing games into education, to mainstream education. On the basis that children who struggle reading or struggle with maths or what have you, one of the problems they've got is the lack of engagement. So they don't engage with maths, and they don't engage with reading, and they don't engage with all those things. And role-playing games, because it involves language, it involves storytelling, it involves mathematics, it involves all those things, is a way of engaging people in those things as a form of learning. So it's quite a serious article when you start reading it. And it makes it's a good point. You know, and it reminds me of me and you. I mean, we were no great shakes at school. I mean, I used to hate maths, but it was always peculiar that, you know, I'd hate maths at school, and then I'd go home and play RuneQuest, which involves quite a lot of maths.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an interesting point. But, so it's interesting in itself. I think what's also interesting about it is that it's not really the kind of article you would find in White Dwarf.
No, it's not.
When I look through this issue, it leapt out as being quite different.
let's have a look at my next one then. Okay, this one is this is unlike the others. Is this before Pelennor? So this is issue 14.
Yeah.
And this is a good one. This one, I remember this one from back in the day. This is an issue that had Brian Talbot's Luther Arkwright at its centre. So it was given over, really, to Luther Arkwright. And he did that occasion. I think last time we were up here, we were looking at the Michael Moorcock special.
Yeah.
But this issue kind of introduced Luther Arkwright. If you don't know Luther Arkwright, it's a series of comics that Brian Talbot, I mean, we knew him from Nemesis, didn't we? He did Nemesis the Warlock in 2008.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But he had these series of comics which are fairly Moorcockian, where Luther Arkwright is a kind of character who can step between different parallels of time. So this idea that there's infinite number of parallels running in conjunction to each other, and he kind of moves through these parallels of time in search of the disruptors, because it's a pretty immersive story for scenario for Traveller provided, where people can play. The player characters are Valkyrie team, Beta, and they similarly are moving across these different parallels to try and thwart the schemes of the disruptors. And it's very ambitious in scale. I mean, they do it on that in the centre bit. The only thing about it, imagine, they used to put it on card paper, didn't they, in the middle?
They did, yeah, like this kind of pull-out thing, which was good, really, because you felt like it wasn't part of the magazine. So it was something you could pull out and use and scribble on and do the kind of things as a games master you wanted to do, yeah.
So you can pull it out and use it, and there's actually a specially written Brian Talbot comic as a kind of a briefing. But this is a really good scenario. And do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make a commitment here.
Mm-hmm. Right?
There's a convention coming up.
Yeah.
In Stockport, March the 18th.
Yeah.
Put it in your diary. Because I'm going to run it. Right?
You're going to run that adventure.
I'm going to run it. Well, I'm going to adapt it.
Yeah.
To bring it up today.
Yeah.
30 years old, isn't it? But I've got the RuneQuest 6. Or Mithras, as we've got to call it now, for licensing reasons. RuneQuest 6 is now Mithras, but I'm going to run it for Mithras because it's got a supplement for running adventures in Luther Arkwright.
Oh, right.
So I'm going to adapt it and use this scenario.
Mm.
So, and it's a convention I'm going to run it at Convergence in Stockport on the 18th of March. You can sign up for it if you want.
Well, I've been in games you've run before, but go on then, I will.
So that's there, if anybody wants to do that. So 18th of March 2017, I'm going to run it because it's interesting. It's an interesting adventure.
Yeah. I understand it is an interesting magazine, isn't it?
Right, before we go, I've got this issue here.
Okay.
One of the early ones, this number 12.
Yeah.
Okay. And they had a board game in there called Nah, Sorry Mate, More of Me Job's Worth. More of Me Job's Worth.
More of Me Job's Worth. It's like all one word.
All one word.
All one word, yeah.
More than my job's
worth. More than my job's worth.
More than my job's worth. We need to
More of My Job's Worth.
More than my job's worth, yeah. We should say for our international listeners, More Than My Job's Worth was a kind of means of usually public sector people diffusing situations where they were being
asked to do something.
Yeah. So if you, can you tell me where platform two is, please? It is more than my job's worth.
More than my job's worth. To tell you. Yeah. It's the kind of thing in a classic sitcom. Someone on the door of a building or a hotel that someone wanted to get into. Would you let me in? I can't let you in. It's more than my job's worth.
More than my job's worth.
Yes. Yeah. So obstructive official.
Yeah, and it's a kind of idiom, isn't it? You know?
Yes.
It doesn't have any currency anymore, because thankfully, due to Mrs. Thatcher's economic revolution. No more public sector workers, and the whole country works like clockwork. Yeah.
And you can't say it's more than my job's worth, because your job's not worth very much in the public sector anymore. So it doesn't really work.
So, can I ask you, Blythe, have you ever wondered what it's like working for a games company like TSR?
All the time. I never stop wondering.
Or what kind of people end up doing it. Have you ever wondered that?
I have wondered both things.
Right, well, we'll take it from us. It's no bed of roses.
Okay. Really?
Yeah. Interdepartmental bitter rivalry. Right?
Really?
Okay. So this game simulates the experience of working for TSR.
Simulation of interdepartmental rivalry?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you get this checkbook.
I'm intrigued by this. This sounds good. This sounds better than swinging a sword around or casting a fireball. This is interdepartmental rivalry.
This is how I could have resolved the problem with the traveller bureaucracy game. This is what I was missing.
Yeah, you could, couldn't you?
So here we go. We've got this checkerboard here.
Okay.
So, right, first of all, we need to decide, are you going to be publications?
Yeah.
Or you can be sales. Publication, not sales.
No magic user. Okay. I'll be publications, I think. Publications. Sounds slightly more erudite, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'll be sales.
Yes, I think it should be.
I'll be sales. Okay. So, right, what we've got here, so on that side of the board there, that last line there,
yes,
that's your in tray.
Okay.
And this one on my side is my
in tray.
Your
in tray, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so what we've got to do around here, we've got these here, these eight counters here, put them there. Mm-hmm. There. That's your publications team.
Okay.
And this is my sales team.
Okay, yeah.
And this one in the middle here is the book. Okay.
Okay.
So you've got to pass the book.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Can you see what they've done?
I can see what they've done.
So the two departments have just received very separate memos and they're very embarrassing. Okay. Just what horrors are pretended in these documents, only you can guess. But if the all-powerful managing director catches your department with one of those memorandum, do you remember them?
There's no emails, it's just memorandum.
It's a memorandum.
It's a piece of paper. Throw it in the bin. Shred it.
If you're fine with it, it's going to be curtains for everybody. There's only one way you can save your bacon. You must get your memo, the book. Right?
Yeah.
The book.
Yeah. That's the book that's passed
into the other player's interest.
Yes, I see.
Yeah. So, okay. So we've got to decide who goes first. Now, it suggests here that you do it as an arm wrestle.
We're not going to stoop to those depths.
So while we have a game of this, let's listen to Paul Coburn and let's see if this is an effective simulation of what it was like. Okay.
Okay.
Over to Paul. See you next time, bye.
All right, see you, bye.
Bye.
Paul Coburn, open box.
Thanks to the wonders of modern technology, I'm able to reach beyond the den using string and two cups to go beyond the shores. Well, right to Middle Earth itself, New Zealand. Back in the day, the period that we cover in the Grognard Files, a very influential figure on the UK gaming scene, and most notably the assistant editor of Imagine magazine, which was published by TSR. So how did you, let's start at the beginning, how did you get into the hobby? How did you start gaming?
There was, I can't remember, it might have been Time Out. There was just an advert for one of the old games days that used to take place in the Royal Horticultural Halls in London, and I was living in London at the time. I know the word game, I know the word day, and then there's all this other stuff after it I don't recognise. What's this Dungeons and Dragons stuff? What's this RuneQuest stuff? I've always war gamed, you know, going back to the whole, you know, playing with toy soldiers on the stairs kind of thing. So I was peripherally involved in a hobby I didn't even know existed. And then this advert appeared, and I was like, oh, yeah, no, let's go and do this. And came back from that with the Redbox edition of Basic D&D, played it with my then wife and her sister in ways that, you know, just completely are not recognisable from what we call role-playing. And then just kind of went, well, now, this is really cool. Found some other people that did it. And then almost immediately, this advert appeared that said that this outfit in Cambridge was looking for an editor for a new magazine they were going to launch. And I had a little bit of publishing experience by then in the job that I was doing. And I was like, you know, this sounds cool. I've really enjoyed being part of this hobby. I'll apply. And ended up... it ended up being more complicated than just getting the editor's job, because they decided I didn't have enough experience. They hired a professional editor who'd worked on, I don't know, it was, I kind of can't remember the exact title she'd worked on, but it was like Condé Nast titles. It was, you know, women's magazines and travel magazines and stuff like that. But she had, you know, boatloads of professional experience. But then on the day I arrive, she and I just had this enormous falling out, and it looks like I'm not going to survive to the end of the week. She then goes over to Lake Geneva to meet all of the people on Dragon and what have you, comes back and gets fired for reasons. And then they're all looking at me and kind of going, well, yeah, we don't think you had enough experience, as we've already explained, but we're going to cut you loose on this thing. And what they did, and the reason that I'm billed as assistant editor, is they brought in another guy who had production experience, right. He knew his way around print, he knew his way around, you know, and they just figured this is the guy that will ensure that Paul hits deadlines. This is the guy that will ensure that he doesn't kind of, you know, run loose with the budget. So a guy called Keith Thompson, who was an incredible mentor and a really smart guy, he came in, but he had nothing to do with content or what have you, because he had no background in gaming or anything like that at all. He was just there to keep me under control. And myself, Mike Brunton, Kim Daniels, we were the three that pushed the magazine out every month.
So it was as simple as that. You were playing Basic D&D. You saw an advert in The Guardian and went for it.
In The Guardian, Yeah, and went for it. Yeah, absolutely. And it was... The hobby was tiny then. You'd think now, you know, if whatever parallel you want to put out, if a games company put an advert in The Guardian and said, we're looking for this incredibly kind of influential and fun position, they would be swamped with zillions of applicants. But the hobby was tiny then, and I think they didn't get staggering numbers of applications, and they didn't interview that many people, which is lucky for me.
And so at that point, what stage was TSR UK at? Was it fairly well established, or was this at the beginnings of it?
Not at the beginnings. I really wouldn't like to try and guess or remember how long it had been going, but it was settled. TSR was obviously, TSR Inc. Was still an independent entity in the States. TSR UK was set up as a wholly owned subsidiary because Don Turnbull and Gary Gygax were buddies. And Don Turnbull, sorry, for people who don't know that, I'm going to assume everybody knows who Gary Gygax was. Don Turnbull was the incredibly personable and well-known figure who was in charge of TSR UK back then, now passed on, sadly. So TSR UK was firmly established as the distributor for all of TSR's products here in UK, and I think had some responsibility for Europe, although I'm not 100% sure on that one. And one of the things that Don kept telling the Americans is, we're in this hopeless position because there's only one way for us to market these products. You know, we can't afford TV advertising or general press advertising, and besides, where would you target that? The only vehicle to promote these products is White Dwarf, and it's owned by a competitor. So I think the logic always was, what we want is our vehicle. And we'll obviously get back to this a bit more as we go through this chat. There was always a good friendly rivalry between Imagine and White Dwarf, but it kind of, it does come from a basis of fact in that Don Turnbull wanted us to take White Dwarf's audience and, you know, go past it and develop it and just be this vehicle to promote D&D and Star Frontiers and, yeah, everything else that came after.
And it's really good, Paul, to hear some warm words about Don Turnbull, because when he's appeared in the podcast previously, it's been in reference to snippy letters that he sent to White Dwarf, complaining about something that Lewis Pulsifer had written, or Ken Saint-André about the orthodoxy of D&D. So
that's him. Yeah. It's one of those lovely things is that the guys who originally came in and found D&D by whatever mechanism and started playing it in the UK, they were playing really the most old school of old school role playing. And I've always said that there was that class of players, and I know a few guys like it still now, who, for D&D is a game that you can win. D&D is a game, it's like Ludo, and the, you know what the winning position is in Ludo. Well, there's a kind of an equivalent winning position in D&D, and your goal is to, you know, maximize what you do with your character, and hopefully you get lucky with some dice rolls, and you beat the system, you beat the GM, and get this, you know, fantastic sense of achievement at the end. And guys like me coming along in the middle 80s who were kind of going, oh, actually, you can do all this kind of story and character development. Don just used to look at people like us and go, what are you talking about? So he was absolutely old school, and therefore the kind of player that he was informed the kind of guy he was in charge of a company, in charge of kind of being, you know, very much part of the public face of TSR. Don Wood kind of go, no, that's not how you play Dungeons and Dragons. So yes, was constantly kind of prepared to have little written letter rows with people over minutiae. But in fairness to the guy, I mean, you know, you will hear people who don't have necessarily fond memories of Don Turnbull, but he could be an incredibly engaging and amusing. He was, you know, up until the end, I had no issues with him as a boss at all. And you kind of watched him around the hobby. You know, he's an older man when Imagine comes out, and during this kind of very big growth of the hobby in the 80s. But people respected him and kind of were amused by him. Don could carry a conversation about gaming and be erudite and amusing. He was, he was an interesting, amusing, intelligent guy.
I know it's a long time ago now, Paul, but for our benefit, it'd be good if you could take us right back to that first issue and how that came about, that what the experience was putting that first issue out.
Pretty terrifying, as I'm sure you can guess. Obviously, you know, I've not come in at the very beginning. I wasn't there for any kind of strategic discussion about what the magazine was going to be about. Which was very much down to Don Turnbull in conversation with the Americans and Tom Kirby, who is now, what is Tom Kirby's job title these days? Anyway, Uber God of Games Workshop, who was TSR's general manager. He and Tom Kirby and Don Turnbull basically kind of put the strategic shaping of it together. But then this kind of, you know, complete numbskull of a kid comes along. I'm in my middle 20s at this point. And it's like, and now we want you to execute this because we fired that other woman, and you know, what? And so there was very little on the table when I walked through the door, and we didn't have a staggering amount of time to kind of plan and get the first issue out. It was going to, I think we had about 3 months from memory, although again, I might be wrong there, might be a bit more. And so, what's it going to do? What are we going to do about it? And certain decisions had been made, like there'd been this thing called the RPGA newsletter, the Role Playing Games Association newsletter, that a guy called Graham Morris put out within the company. And that was always going to be folded into Imagine. So that was one thing that was going to happen. We were going to try and talk to new people. We were going to try and proselytize for the hobby. So it had to be introductory. At the same time, it had to cater for reasonably, you know, experienced and what have you players. And we had to do everything better than White Dwarf. So there was this kind of open-ended nature to it, which was incredibly exciting. It allowed me and the rest of the team to kind of experiment with what we were going to do and how we were going to do it, which meant, of course, we made, you know, incredible mistakes. But it was also quite terrifying because it really was a case, what if the whole thing is a mistake? What if this is absolutely not what people want? And therefore, when the first one came out and people were, we started seeing reviews in fanzines and what have you, and people were like, yeah, and we were obviously like, not hitting the mark straight away, and people were kind of going, you know, they've got a long way before this is as good a magazine as White Dwarf, but we hadn't fouled up, so it was like, okay, so now let's start evolving and moving this thing along.
Yeah, I seem to remember that it had a pretty good distribution. It seemed to have more of a newsagent presence than even White Dwarf at that time, so I expect the pressure was high. Because it was going out so widely.
Yes. I never was involved in kind of discussions. I think we got some distribution through WH Smith and stuff like that. Never was involved at that kind of level. But it was a sense that, you know, if the sales numbers come back and they are dire, this thing will obviously get canned really, really quickly. Because of the nature, because Don had wanted to do this independent thing, and I'll backtrack slightly to go, the Americans' vision of what was going to happen with this magazine that Don had persuaded them to do was incredibly different. I've seen some transcripts of some interviews Gary Gygax gave back before he died, and his expectations of what was going to happen in the UK were utterly, utterly different. So, you know, we didn't have a lot of time. This was going to have to get right quickly. And that meant that there wasn't going to be, you know, a year of dire circulation numbers that were picking up and therefore we could just keep going until we got it right. We needed decent numbers fairly quickly. And so the learning curve, not just getting the first one out, but then watching the reaction to that and going, okay, here's what we got right, here's what we got wrong. More of the first, less of the latter. Let's go again. And I kind of look back on those early issues, and I have kind of skimmed them over relatively recently and gone, yeah, you can just see how raw and uninformed some of the first, I don't know, few are. But then there comes a point when we start to hit our stride a bit.
Yeah, and we'll go and we'll look at some of the things that featured in Imagine and how you kind of started to get that voice by looking at some of those specific things. So you mentioned there that, you know, the parent company, TSR, had different expectations. What were they looking for? Kind of a repeat of Dragon in the US?
Yeah, and it's all part of the really kind of interesting tactical confusion with all this, because you start from a point where, as I say, Don was going, oh, White Dwarf is our only advertising vehicle, that's a problem. And the Yanks would go, can't we just make Dragon work in the UK? And there was absolutely no evidence of that being the case. Dragon sold okay to some really deep aficionados, but that was it. It wasn't doing anything. So one of the things I've read that Gary Gygax was saying at the time is, well, what we do is we strip out all of the, you know, American convention stuff and anything that's kind of territorially specific, and you add that then for the UK. You do all your clubs and your British based conventions and news and stuff like that. And I think he even said, you know, it should be called Royal Dragon because that will sound British. And that's what we do. Effectively, you tap into this great well of content that there is, because Dragon have been going for, you know, God knows how long, and use that, but just you know, put all this UK branding, well, not branding, UK information around it. But we, Don's argument was, no, Dragon is like, that's too low a starting point. The numbers of Dragon that we sell each month are tiny, and nobody in the UK is kind of going, thank goodness we've got Dragon, because that's giving us what we need. So the idea that you could just, you know, repeat, I don't know, three quarters of the magazine and then stick some stuff about British clubs in, you know, Don was just, no, that won't work. So this huge divergence of opinion about what it was going to be. And one of the things I really remember from my kind of first week was, we knew we were going to get the Barbarian character class, not in time to launch, but for issue two. Cool. And I was like, you know, every time something like that comes out from the parent company, that's going to be a godsend to us. In terms of the UK audience, we will introduce it. And that'll be, you know, that'll be awesome. But of course, there's not that much of that stuff. So when we're then being told, oh, you can also have this article, you know, written by one of the main guys in the States, how to play an 80th level paladin, and yet here we are trying to sell something that's also of utility to newbies. We were like, this isn't going to work for us, because we already know that, because Dragon doesn't sell. So yeah, it was, there was a lot of tension around that. And I, as I say, I know that some of the top guys in the States thought we were a little bit out of control, a little bit up ourselves, trying to do this thing and not drawing more on their experience. And one of the things I think is true is I wish I'd had more time talking with my opposite number on Dragon, but we just, in the end, we couldn't draw on American material as much as I think everybody had assumed originally, because it just didn't fit.
And during this time, Paul, were you able to play? So were you still playing, or was your taken up with being an editor?
It was a pretty full on experience. But you know, you're living in an environment like that, where the TSR UK were based in a place called the Mill. It was an old converted mill building, and a very cool environment to be in. And there was kind of some space for gaming tables and what have you on in one of the rooms. So we did, and the guys who got hired to write the UK series of modules were kind of doing stuff. So you play test those, you play test all the stuff that was going to be used for demo games in Games Day or Games Fair. So there was this environment of stuff all around. Plus, you know, once we decided that we weren't just a TSR house magazine, we had visitors come over and we'd be introduced to other games. And I can remember us playing a Call of Cthulhu scenario for the first time. And I was like, oh no, this is me. The Dungeons and Dragons stuff, that's fun. But this is what I want to do. So I was gaming as much as possible. The guy who introduced you and I, with Tom Kirby, was running a games club in a village just outside Cambridge, and that's where I met Sam, the guy that introduced us. And so I was on a weekly basis playing with a bunch of kids, most of whom I've kept in contact one way or another. And every now and again, we would just like try something weird on them. We're going to talk about Pelennor later on, but Pelennor was field tested on this gaming club.
Yeah, I mean, we should say thank you to Sam Vale. He's been a big supporter of the podcast, and he brought us together. So we should acknowledge that. So thank you.
Yes. Sam's matchmaking. He'll be thrilled.
And what about now, Paul? Do you still play?
I'm currently in a little bit of a hiatus because the gaming group, I'm in Wellington, New Zealand now, as we were joking around at the start. I'm down in the lands of the Hobbits and joined the gaming group pretty well straight away. But we're a female-dominated group. There are more women players than men, and two of the women have just had kids. So we're in a little bit of a hiatus until sanity returns to their lives. We've ball games. We can do occasional things, but it's just hard to do the weekly gaming thing. So, yeah, we're hoping to get that back on track. New Zealand's a huge indie gaming thing. You know, I was like, I need a really good Call of Cthulhu campaign I can drop into. So I'll go in the local game store and I'll kind of, you know, check on the internet and I'll just find some, what's this? And they really are. They're into their indie games. They're into their one-shot games. So I've been to a couple of games conventions here in Wellington and it's just a hoot because it's like you have no idea what you're going to run into. People just kind of, I've got this pickup game. Oh, yeah, well, yeah, and you're a movie producer. And, oh, my God. Okay. So I really do, because I'm, you know, I'm now old school, I look back and or look around and go, I still want that Call of Cthulhu campaign. But actually an awful lot of what we do is just experimental stuff. And that kind of fits me because in my last few years in the UK, we were gaming diceless. We had a kind of, we used to use, I think originally magic cards and then tarot cards. We'd use things for kind of imaginative spur of the moment stuff, you know, something that could kind of give you a quick hook rather than you necessarily having to make a decision. But yeah, we went diceless. We had this huge campaign that lasted for about 10 years.
And what setting was that? What game was that?
This was the now infamous Tibor campaign. It was basically that the fallen angels from the Bible were effectively the ruling classes of European society. This is set in 16th century Hungary because you know you can never obscure to never gain too obscurely. So basically, there's a huge. This is when the Ottoman Empire is basically taking over Eastern Europe, and our focal point. There's a huge battle that's not kind of very well known in the West, at a place called Mohács, 1526. It's just south of Budapest, and this is like the destruction of the Kingdom of Hungary and the Turks take over. And we basically just use that as a center point. It was going to be. An end point of one of our kind of mega chapters as a historical hook to pin this thing of, but in the background, a lot of these famous people, a lot of the ruling classes and the high churchmen and this, that and the other are, we always used to lazily call them vampires, but we never really meant them as vampires. They're the fallen angels. They are these incredibly ancient spirits that take on human form and basically when you look at a dynasty that's got, you know, that's particularly sinister, say the Bathory clan in Hungary, it's actually only, it's one person, it's one individual consciousness that inhabits, you know, different generations. So our poor player characters were just bumping up, you know, against stuff that was way too powerful for them from the very beginning, at a time in which Eastern Europe is, you know, on fire and ablaze. So, yeah, it was enormous fun, and I miss that kind of. We all have a rough idea of where this game is going to go, but this is just like deep storytelling.
And has any of that been published, Paul?
No, there's a very good friend of mine, Simon Taylor, who's from your neck of the world, judging by accents. And Cy Taylor and I have talked about this any number of times. And in the era of Kickstarter, it's repeatedly a temptation to do it. It's incredibly hard because we're very aware now of how of the complexity and depth that we put into that story. And it's whether that actually then translates into... There were three of us who were GMing it. Whether another group of GMs could actually use that without us having to provide so much kind of additional material and so many other possibilities that it would just drown under the weight of it. So we've looked at this and there are drafts of some of the early stuff kicking around on various computers, but we've never actually had the chutzpah to go, no, let's stick a year of our lives aside and make this happen.
White Dwarf.
White Dwarf goes critical. Issue 39 and a bold new look for White Dwarf was introduced. Gone was the distinctive Art Nouveau logo, now replaced by big, blocky, in-your-face title. This is White Dwarf. More pages and new styling were brought in, and new games were covered, starting with Champions, a superhero RPG, no less. Whatever next? The venerable dwarf himself was reduced to a mere silhouette on the contents page, although this proved to be a change too far, and he was reinstated a few issues later. Oh, and there was a new book review column. I suspect many of us didn't realise at the time just how influential and indispensable Critical Mass was to become, and how quickly. Many other attempts at regular columns on topics related to RPGs, computing, films, board games, came and went, while Critical Mass carried on strong, perennially popular with the readers. There was a reason for that. Dave Langford. White Dwarf really struck the jackpot with Dave Langford. The multi-Hugo Award-winning author and critic made Critical Mass column required reading from the start. He brought an insight and real depth of knowledge about science fiction and fantasy genres to the job. His reviews were invariably a joy to read. He praised excellence, but brought his acerbic wit to bear on some of the most memorable put-downs of mediocre works in the field. But always his affection for the genre shone through. Looking back at all the Critical Mass columns now, you can only marvel at the sheer number and range of books that Dave Langford covered. He looked beyond the hyped blockbusters of the day to also bring us reviews of some of the quirkier, left-field books that were published at the time. This brought authors to White Dwarf readers' attention that may otherwise have not have heard of. I'm personally grateful that I was introduced to John Crowley, Jonathan Carroll, and M. John Harrison through entries in Critical Mass. Through a relatively short review, Dave Langford could really excite you about a book. And as friend of the Grognard Files, Big Jack Brass, noted on Twitter a while back, there was no such thing as a plot spoiler in a Dave Langford review. Even if he did detail events in the story, it was so deftly written that it just made you want to read it even more. Perhaps it's just me, but I always got the impression that Dave Langford preferred SF to fantasy. He seemed more comfortable reviewing the likes of Brian Aldiss, Ian Watson and Bob Shaw. With the fantasy genre, I think he was ground down by having to continually scale mountains of high fantasy doorstops, set in a land of portentous capital letters where a dark lord sat on his mountain ring lair, presumably hoarding all the vowels. He did wonder why anyone would want to be a Dark Lord at all. They all get zapped with such a monotonous success that you'd think that school careers officers would have long ago stopped recommending Black Lordship jobs. Evil should be closer to home. His preferences in the fantasy genre tended towards the humour of the likes of James Branch Cabell and Terry Pratchett, or, as mentioned, works more on the fringes of conventional fantasy, with authors like John Crowley and Robert Holstock, who brought genuine innovation to the field. It's probably inevitable that negative reviews tend to be more memorable than the positive reviews. Of the latter, a couple stick in the mind are reviews of Ramsay Campbell's The Hungry Moon and Jonathan Carroll's Bones of the Moon, both of which I bought and read on the strength of their reviews in critical mass, Dave Langford was clearly a fan of Ramsey Campbell's understated approach to horror, and highlighted the book's twin threats of an ancient evil coupled with scary biblical fundamentalists. Which of the two is more frightening, I'll leave you to decide. It's a great example of Campbell's complex, layered approach to building a genuinely unnerving narrative. And, as Langford concluded, definitely a book to make you draw the curtains and turn up the central heating. Langford also had warm words for Jonathan Carroll's hallucinatory, dream-infused novel, where oblique fantasy takes a darker turn and erupts into real-world violence. For what it's worth, I'll add my own personal recommendation for Bones of the Moon. The main characters are so well drawn that I felt a real sense of loss when I'd finished the book, as I'd be no longer sharing their story. But I think Dave Langford was at his very best with his merciless excoriations of mediocrity. These reviews were always hugely enjoyable to read, even when he was having a go at an author I like, which of course brings me to, who else, Stephen Donaldson. This author cropped up quite a few times in early critical mass columns. I think it's fair to say that, overall, Dave Langford wasn't a fan. Like many other reviewers, he found Donaldson's excess verbiage off-putting, along with the tortured angst of the main protagonist. Having said that, he also found Donaldson's convoluted approach to fantasy original and welcome, even if that did mean he had to wade through 3,000 pages of unremitting covenant. His fairly even-handed approach put Dave Langford in a position of being taken to task by both Donaldson fans and those who felt that Donaldson should be never let near a word processor again. For my own part, I am an unabashed Donaldson fan. I'm willing to put up with the dictionary swallowing and rather solipsistic characters. Donaldson's viewpoint is novel. He tells stories about people with real concerns, and ultimately, he can spin a really good yarn. And then there was possibly Dave Langford's most famous review of all, his expert takedown of Battlefield Earth by everyone's favourite science fiction writing bizarro cult founder and charlatan, L. Ron Hubbard. The review was infused with sheer incredulity that a book so offensively bad could have been written. Dave Langford listed several examples of Hubbardian science that are frankly laughable. The fact that the book continued in this vein for over 800 pages, he found dreadful and tedious beyond endurance. It's very tempting to quote the review in full. However, I encourage you to visit Dave's website, ansible.uk. ANSIBLE.UK, and buy the Complete Critical Assembly instead. This collects all of the Critical Mass columns in one volume, together with columns he wrote for some other RPG magazine. Do yourself a favour and buy a copy, and then you can read and reread the Battlefield Earth review along with all the others at your leisure. You won't regret it. Reading all the Critical Mass columns together is simply a joy, with the occasional wince-inducing embarrassment for a poor author caught in the Langford crosshairs. Honest, funny, precipient, he reviewed without fear or favour, and occasionally he was not beyond, if not exactly biting, then at least giving the hand that fed him a bit of a nip, with some arch comments on fighting fantasy game books, and latterly Warhammer novelizations too. Ah yes, Warhammer. In the late 80s, the Warhammer juggernaut really started to roll. As White Dwarf changed before our eyes and stopped being a role-playing games magazine. The one remaining constant in the sea of change was Critical Mass. But then, in issue 106, came the announcement that Critical Mass was ending. And with that, at least for me, there was no real reason to buy the magazine anymore. And so, 106 was my last issue too. The final link to the magazine had been such an influence on my teenage years was gone. Overhead, without any fuss, White Dwarf magazine had gone out.
Postbag!
On the subject of Imagine magazine, I've received this from DM Mike. We at Save or Die have recently hit a conundrum that we hope you can help with. In episode 126, we reviewed Imagine magazine's Pelennor campaign. As part of the review, Liz brought up the description of an NPC that she felt rather strongly about. In particular, the female elf named Goldmeadow was the bee in her gaming bonnet. When it came to the description of any unusual qualities the NPC had, for Goldmeadow it simply said she smelled wonderful. For brevity's sake, I'll simply say that she was annoyed. The discussion then went on to sniffing of NPCs by player characters. As Save or Die has gone on, we've discovered that there were D&D play styles across the US that differed noticeably from each other. Great late gamers tended to hire lots of hirelings. West Coast gamers tended to use gonzo spells and torchbearers, while Southern gamers tended to eschew both. So, could you please let us know if sniffing was a unique aspect of the UK D&D gaming scene? Well, Mike, it's a difficult one, this one. My NPC has no nose. How does it smell? I don't know. You'll have to roll for it. And what's striking about the way that NPCs were presented in Pelennor is that they were described beyond stat blocks. There was sensory information about them, rumours that they might be aware of. Smelling wonderful provides something distinctive and memorable about the character, rather than presenting a high charisma stat, for example. In the early 80s, in the UK, there was a war going on. The power gamers versus the burgeoning story gamers. Imagine was one of the battlegrounds. In the next episode, Paul Coburn will be going on the other side of the Games Master screen, and I'll roll on a table and look at some of the features from Imagine, including Pelennor. So, the fanzine is ready for dispatch. It officially launched in Manchester at the first Grognard Files meetup, the Grog Meet, in November. To our surprise, it turns out that they're actual living, breathing humans actually listening to these bobbins, and we got to meet some of them. Find out more about it and about the fanzine at thegrognardfiles.com. The podcast and other projects are supported by our virtual tip jar on Patreon. And we have some new Patreons. So first up, thank you to Phil Baldowski, who is an honorary member of the Armchair Adventurers. Phil produces great gaming accessories. Her store, All Rolled Up, was present at our first ever Grog Meet, and she very kindly donated bespoke prizes for the event. Thank you very much, Phil, and welcome on board. At $3.50, there's Industrial. Yes, that's Industrial. Thanks, Industrial. For those who are throwing in $5 or more, I gave them a gift from a random table, relevant to the subject under discussion. So it's a bit tricky, this one. So I've gone for issue 26 of Imagine here. And this is the issue where Roger Musson revisited the Monster Mark for some reason. And there's a scenario called The Great Paladin Hunt, which we always liked, as there's an illustration that looks the spitting image of the popular footballer stroke 80s soccer pundit Jimmy Greaves. Check that out if you can. Okay, I'm going to roll on the Wayfarer's Table from Paul Vernon's Fellow Travellers article, which was all about people that you might meet on the road in D&D. Okay, so first up is Stephen Andrews. Is it D100? Oh, 81. A bailiff. Oh, you've got a bailiff. So that's useful for collecting debts, and you can save your knuckles. Thanks, Stephen. Okay, next up is Andrew Cowie, who is at Grogmeat and has kindly upped his pledge level. And he's got 34. And 34 is a clogger. So you can fix your shoes while on the road. Thank you very much, Andrew. Talking of cobblers, Andrew attempted to do an impression of us, reflecting our northern accent and laid-back style. Well, we're learning about podcasting all the time here at the Grognard Files. I don't have the natural voice for radio, but I'm always learning. So here's a good lesson. When you're doing an interview, make sure you get the interviewee's name right. For example. Now, so I've got Paul Cockburn with me over in New Zealand.
First of all, what a terrible way to introduce yourself. It's Coburn, not Cockburn.
Coburn, right,
and
okay.
This clearly shows that it's time that Coburn's Port ran their Christmas adverts again, because for anybody of a certain age, they'll recall that they always used to check the pronunciation.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a kid, and they were running those adverts back then, when I was a kid, it was such a blessing in some ways to know that any teacher who looked at a booze advert over Christmas, you know, the following January and what have you, they'd know how to pronounce my name at last. And this was a blessing. Except, of course, all the kids at school would have gone, "We saw your advert." And they would just give you an incredibly hard time and follow you around the playground going, "It's not cock, it's co." So, you know, good times.
So you're not a cock, you're a co.
I am indeed not a... Oh, plenty of people tell you I am a cock, but...
Adios, amigos.